Hello and welcome to Underscore, the podcast from Asa Allen, featuring leading experts in economics and public policy. I'm your host and CEO of Asa Allen, Paul Hislop. We're joined here today by my colleague Annabelle Brebner to discuss mental health reform in Australia, especially following the Productivity Commission's 2020 inquiry into mental health. Mental health was already facing something of a crisis prior to the COVID-19 pandemic. While the full impact of the pandemic on mental health in Australia is not really yet fully understood, anecdotal evidence indicates that the imposed restrictions on movement, isolation, and financial stress have led to significant increases in the demand for services from a system that is already thinly stretched. My colleague Annabelle is a director at ASA Allen and is a social policy expert. Annabelle has been involved in the development and analysis of a wide range of complex social programs and their evaluation throughout her career. Annabelle, how are you? I'm so glad you could join me here today.
I'm very well, thanks, Paul. How are you today?
Good, thank you. Once upon a time, we didn't really talk about mental health. At least that's my recollection. Over recent decades, it seems to be something that's come more to the surface. And we now seem to be ready to talk about it quite a bit. What do you think's happened there? And should this be seen in a positive light, or does it mean that something bad is happening within Australian society?
I think it's a really interesting question, Paul. And certainly attitudes to talking about mental ill health have changed dramatically, probably over the last couple of decades, but particularly over the last 5 to 10 years, I would say. I think there have been some fundamental proponents of reform and change who've actually taken it as their initiative to speak about mental ill health. And quite often that's been because of personal experience or experiences in their families. And they've been prepared to actually share information and share the impact that mental ill health has had for them and for people that they know. We've also seen organisations like Beyond Blue established and with some high profile people behind them in the first instance that were able to really raise the profile of a discussion about mental health. And we've also seen a lot of sporting participants, sporting heroes, take up a willingness to actually discuss their own experiences with mental health problems and also to share that journey with other people. In terms of whether that's a good thing or not, I think it is a good thing because for people to suffer quietly is not good. It means that they're not receiving help and there is help available. And that's one of the really important messages, you know, for people to understand is that it's not something that people have to deal with on their own.
I remember if I think back over my own life and particularly as a child and growing up as a young adult, you know, I think we sort of always knew there were some people that we thought they were just a little bit weird, you know, and there was something wrong with them. And we actually sort of put that down to them, their fault.
Yeah.
We seem to have now turned the corner on that and accepted that this is not something that's necessarily in their control and that they really do need help. But not only that, that if we can give help and it can actually improve their lives dramatically.
That's right. And I think mental health is just like physical health in that there's a wide range of things that can go wrong and they can be temporary illnesses or temporary periods of distress, or they can be really serious and chronic illnesses. The extent to which people suffer from those really serious chronic illnesses that perhaps might be some of those that you're thinking about, you know, that's a really small percentage of the population that really suffer with those ongoing, lifelong, debilitating illnesses. However, mental ill health is really common. And, you know, as the stats say, you know, 1 in 5 Australians will suffer from mental ill health in any year. And, you know, around 40-45% of Australians will suffer from mental ill health at some stage in their lifetime. So that's a really big number. And if there's things that we can do to help people, which there are, you know, it's like if you break your leg, you're not going to think, well, I should just make it get better myself. You go off to the doctor and you get some help and you get it set and you recover. And you learn some things maybe along the way, say if you've got a bad back or something like that, you do some preventative stuff that makes you less likely to develop problems in the future. And it's exactly the same And so we're, you know, you're seeing a lot of effort through schools, et cetera, trying to build resilience or whatever the word of the moment might be, but just trying to give people the skills that they need to be able to manage their lives well, manage stress as well, and also to be able to know and read the signs of when they actually do need help and when they can just, when they don't need help, when they can actually say, no, I can pick myself up from this, I can do it, I've got the skills myself. Or, no, things are really going off the track here. I need to reach out to somebody else who can give me some professional advice. And so I think building those sorts of skills is really important. And I don't think we need to see it as being signs of weakness or signs of softness. It's actually saying, no, there's some skills here that I need to build, some, you know, mental fitness, just like there's physical fitness. And also there's a point where, no, it's gone too far and I actually do need some help and I know where to go to get that help. And that's got to be helpful for everybody.
So it's not just about, not that there's not a place for it, I imagine, but it's not just about sending someone down to the local psychiatrist or the local doctor and getting them plugged up with drugs. There's a lot more to helping people with mental illness.
That's right. And I think that's one of the things that came through really strongly in the Productivity Commission report and also in the Royal Commission that's been completed here in Victoria, that there's a wide range of treatment and support pathways available to people. And seeing a psychiatrist may well be the right pathway for somebody to go down, but it's not necessarily the right pathway and it's not the only pathway. Oftentimes people who are particularly suffering from anxiety and depression related disorders require help with other parts of their life and they're actually not able to continue with their recovery until they get some help with some of those other things in their lives. So that's why you need a team of people to assist or to at least do that triaging that says, actually, this person's in severe financial distress and they're at risk of losing their home. There's no point in us really starting to talk about some of the deep-seated anxiety issues until we actually get them into a stable home. So that's where the range of options and the types of supports, you know, social workers and psychologists and sometimes it might be occupational therapists or there's a whole range of people who can actually provide that assistance to somebody that has nothing to do with taking, you know, drugs or pharmaceuticals that might be what some people are afraid of and do have side effects that need to be considered. As I said, sometimes they're the right option, but it's usually in a suite of options. And people have choice as to what's going to be right for them.
Yeah, I think it's easy to understand where someone gets to the point of self-harm and even mortal self-harm, why you would want to step in and provide support. But there's a lot more than just physical harm to people that flows from this. And I say that because I think Productivity Commission report that you refer to came up with a number of somewhere around $200 billion per annum that was the cost of mental illness in Australia. So that suggests to me that's more than people leading to self-harm. There must be a wide range of costs to the community. What's in that? What leads to that $200 billion estimate?
Yeah. And again, it's a really good avenue for us to explore. There's a significant cost that's the direct costs of providing the healthcare. And so that's you know, diagnosis and treatment sort of work. That's the promotional activity that I spoke to about before, about programs in schools, et cetera. But there's also some components there around housing, justice, employment sort of initiatives. But they're actually at the smaller end of the scale in terms of the contribution to that cost. There's a really big cost in terms of the loss of participation in work and loss of participation in education that then leads to better employment opportunities for people as they progress through their lives. So if people are disengaging from school because they're unwell, they don't complete their education, they can't get the jobs that they want, there's sometimes they can't get a job at all. So they're in a cycle of being having costs to the through the social services system, but also there's that lost employment and therefore lost, you know, taxation and lost spending to the economy. Around that person, particularly when you get to those serious areas of suicidality or people with really serious mental ill health, you've got carers who usually families or those who are close to the person who quite often step out of the workforce also. So you've got a multiplier effect of lost productivity and contribution to the economy because one person is unwell. There's also, I mean, we often talk about the ripple effect of suicide or suicidality, which really refers to people who attempt suicide, don't necessarily complete it, where, you know, the families, immediate family and friends are significantly impacted by those sorts of events and suffer their own, whether it's depression, whether it's anxiety, but generally a significant loss of productivity as well as the trauma that they experience as a result of those sorts of really life-changing events. And that can also show through in terms of, you know, presenteeism at work, so being at work but not being as productive as they might be, lower levels of turning up for work, so higher levels of absenteeism, and those also have impacts on productivity and on the businesses. You also have another impact of ill health and particularly of things such as suicidality, where people who are then become disabled or unable to work at the capacity that they might have otherwise. And so again, you've got costs to the system through the supports that they require, but also the lost productivity from those people being able to engage in the workplace as they might have been able to had they been well or had they been treated early. And so the acuteness of their illness did not progress. So again, as with a physical illness, if you prevent it, that's the best option. Early intervention is the next best option, where you're actually able to provide people with really good treatment and support early so that their illness does not progress to the point where they're no longer able to work or their recovery journey is longer and more difficult. As I said, it's no different from physical health. And I think that's one of the things that we're starting to see people understand and realise. The other important issue to understand with mental ill health is that it quite often coexists with physical ill health. And because somebody is unwell mentally, they're less likely to seek assistance or help for their physical illnesses. And so they become accentuated and more expensive to treat. And so, again, their ability to participate in the workforce, to live productive lives, to look after their families, et cetera, is reduced. And it has that rippling effect out from the person who's unwell to their families and their broader support groups.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like we capture a lot of the costs, and obviously the hard costs and the loss of productivity, the loss of attendance at work, the additional costs of dealing with physical and mental health. What doesn't seem to be captured in there, and it probably is hard to capture, but I think it is something worth to remember, is people that are suffering mental ill health are also not having as nearly good a life as people who are not suffering from ill health. That probably doesn't get captured. That loss of utility to each individual doesn't get captured in that $200 billion.
That's right. So, I mean, from my perspective, you know, this is a really conservative estimate of what the actual cost is. And that pain and suffering sort of cost and that reduced utility, as you referred to, I mean, it's fundamental and profound. And I think people get to a point in life where they've experienced somebody, either themselves or someone in their families, who've experienced mental ill health, and they know and have seen firsthand just how debilitating that can be, and particularly if there's not the assistance that can be provided, is provided, and is provided in an appropriate way. And this is where we go on to the discussion about the system and the system's capacity to deal with people who are unwell, but also to respond in a timely manner. And there's no doubt from the Productivity Commission report, Royal Commission in Victoria, any of the states and territories, I mean, it's really not disputed that the mental health system is broken. I don't think, I certainly in the last 5 years, I haven't read anything anywhere from any government that pretends that the system isn't broken. Now, that doesn't mean that there's not a lot of work being done to try and improve things, but the reasons for that being broken are multifaceted.
So if it is broken, we must have identified how it's broken. So how would we go about fixing it?
And I think that's where the Productivity Commission report is one really, really good starting point for us, in that it's a really well-structured and in-depth analysis of the systems and the costs, and generates the return on investment that means that we've got a credible basis on which to make some investment decisions. There's no doubt that we've got a shortage of people working in the mental health system across the board. And I mean, there are some tiny pockets where we might have sufficient numbers of sufficient types of people. But as I mentioned before, we're talking about a really diverse workforce here. We're talking about, psychiatrists who are really highly trained and have been through many years of medical school and postgraduate training, et cetera, and required to stay up to date with their training, and really, really highly skilled medical professionals. And there's a shortage of them across the country, everywhere except in metropolitan Adelaide, apparently. They've got enough. But everywhere else in the country, there's actually, really significant shortages of psychiatrists. There's a shortage of GPs generally, but there's also a real shortage of GPs who have specific training in mental health. Now, every GP will see somebody who's experiencing mental ill health. That's just part and parcel of the deal. But there are some who do specialist training in it, and that's a real contribution to a community if you've got one of those nearby. But that's hit and miss, and it's up to people to do that. There's also small things, when I say small, but GPs are running businesses, they've got specified appointment times, and whilst there are some allowances and some MBS items that allow them to charge for a longer period of time, they're really busy, and especially through COVID, the demands on GPs are really, really intense. And so for them to be able to find an appointment time that coincides when someone is in crisis is possibly not going to happen. So what happens then is people end up going to emergency departments, and emergency departments are really not the best place for people who are experiencing a crisis. And we know that, and emergency departments know that. They're trying to do things to have different parts of the emergency department that are specially suited for people who are in crisis, that's separate from other areas. But again, that's resource constrained, there's building constraints, et cetera, staffing ratios, all those sorts of things. We're also talking about psychiatrists and, psychologists, and they come at varying levels of qualification, depending on the training that they've done. And again, many years of experience and training required. And then we go to the psychosocial support, and that can be through social workers, allied health, mental health nurses. Mental health nurses also do clinical work. But there's also a level of navigating the world and developing up those resilience factors that are done by people with a different level of training as well. So it's really broad, and we've got shortages in most of those areas, most of those professions. One of the reasons for that is, people who come through and do, say, nursing, have a wide range of options as to where they can work. And so they can work in children's hospitals, they could work in other public hospitals, private hospitals, a huge range of options available to people. And mental health has been seen as not an attractive workplace. And it's not attractive.
Do you think that's because the money that's paid doesn't sort of encourage people into the community? Or is it that we maybe need to think about, or maybe people are already doing this, think about a different way of thinking about the 40-hour work week. I mean, 40-hour work week, you go to work 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, or maybe 10 hours a day, 4 days a week. Maybe that doesn't work in a mental health environment where it's really full on all the time. You know, maybe the workers need respite and need maybe it needs to be done a different way.
Yeah, look, and again, I think that's a really good point, and it's certainly an important component of why people in some positions have reported that they suffer large levels of burnout, etc. You know, firstly, the work is difficult. I mean, if you're dealing with people who are seriously ill, that's hard work, and the risks associated with that work are significant. And there are elements of balancing and managing that risk that health services have to put in place, because obviously if they make a call that isn't quite right, if somebody's not safe to be in the community, then that person can lose their life, and that's obviously a really sad and bad outcome for everybody concerned. So there's aspects of that that are involved. Because it's not seen as attractive, and you know, it's difficult, it's generally not well paid. There's stigma associated with mental health in the community, and that spills over into the professions that actually care for people who are mentally unwell. So if we speak with psychiatrists, they'll say that some of their other medical specialist colleagues don't necessarily rate their field of practice as highly as they rate others. You know, there's some views that it's still not really very scientific, because, and I would suggest that how the brain operates is a work in progress. We don't know everything about how brains operate, but we know an awful lot more than we used to. And I think it's really selling psychiatrists short to say that they're not really, really highly scientifically trained professionals, because they are. But if you've got that sort of level of stigma at the top of the tree, it flows down throughout the whole sector. And we need to pay people well to do hard work for which they are highly, highly trained, that has high risk involved for the people involved, and the potential for significant cost, as we've talked about, to the economy and to the individuals and their families. But it goes beyond that too. We've got to provide the time in practice for people to have, you know, what they call supervision or reflective practice, where they have actually time away from patient-facing time to talk to colleagues about, to debrief on their own experience, but also to look after their own mental health, but also to make sure that they're, you know, did we make the right decisions here? And so that there's that shared learning. There also needs to be time and the mechanisms put in place for the whole care team to come together, you know, even virtually come together to discuss a patient's progress. And that's difficult to happen outside of an admitted in-hospital environment, because people are so busy.
A little bit of recovery time too, a bit like, yeah, you know, we emergency services that go out to bad car accidents. You know, we accept now that we need to bring them together and have time to recover from the experience.
Exactly. And if you look at police, for example, who are dealing with and responding to mental health crises in the community all the time, I mean, the mental health of the police themselves is a significant contributor to absenteeism amongst police. And so that, it's not only the mental health of the community at large, but it's the mental health of those responding that's really important to deal with as well. And make, you know, I certainly believe that, you know, our first responders are doing significant work in this area, and they are really well aware of the need for additional training, but also that support, so that follow-up support. And in fact, I was out at the police academy this morning in Melbourne, and the command was saying that every day is Are You Okay Day. It's not just one day a year where you wear something yellow. It's every day in their job, and they've really got a really strong focus on it. And I'm sure that's the same across the country.
So we've talked about the Productivity Commission that was commissioned through the federal or the Commonwealth process, the Victorian inquiry. Are the Commonwealth and the various state governments, do you think they're on board with the needs, and do you think they're actually committed to improving the systems? And I include there in particular the money that we need and to provide the resources to improve the system.
Look, I think there's some really positive steps, and I don't want to be, it's easy to jump to all the things that are wrong and say that everything's dreadful and awful. There are some positive steps. So one of those steps is that we've recently had bilateral agreements signed between the Commonwealth and all the state and territory governments just this year. And that's a good step in that we've got a national agreements or the bilateral agreements in mental health and suicide prevention. So that means that it gets the focus and the attention of First Ministers, and that's important in any political process and budgetary process. It also means that the reporting against those agreements has a level of priority and visibility that it doesn't have if it goes through health ministers. So I see that as a really strong commitment to the priority and the importance of mental health. I think the investment being made, most people would view, who work in the sector certainly, or who commentate on the sector, would say that the level of investment in those, through those agreements, was disappointing. And certainly if you look at, say, the recently released budget in Victoria, there's a really significant injection of funding into mental health over and above what has already been put in place, which has been significantly increased since the Royal Commission findings were handed down and recommendations accepted by the government here. So then, and there are other governments too, that are other state and territory governments who are putting significant resources towards mental health. Is it enough? It can never be enough, but, you know, being realistic in a constrained environment, I would say in Victoria, they're doing a significant amount of work. I think the Commonwealth still needs to actually recognise the extent of the problem by addressing it with funding. And really recognising that flow-on effect that it has to other aspects of health, in terms of reducing the acuity of some of the other illnesses because of the comorbidity of physical and mental health, but also, you know, if we're talking about significant reform and that's what everyone agrees is needed, then that's going to be expensive. And it needs a really systematic response to that, and it needs, continuity of employment for those who work in the system. And this is another really significant issue, not so much for your psychiatrists and psychologists, but as you come to some of the other allied health areas, or you come down to some of the psychosocial support workers who play a really crucial role in between the times when people see those treating professionals. And, you know, it's absolutely crucial to understand that people who are significantly mentally unwell need help to be held safe in those times of distress. And that's not going to be a psychiatrist, because they're not available, nor would you want to build a system around somebody with that level of expense, to be quite brutal about it, holding somebody safe at those periods of time. But you do need people to do that work and to be more available. But you've got to give them a reasonable job with a reasonable rate of pay, with reasonable certainty that that position will be ongoing. And that's not the way the system is built at the moment. So there's some real challenges for government there to actually step up and look at all those aspects of reform that are required, in my opinion.
And if we had unlimited budgets and unlimited resources, we could do everything, and we don't. And so there's often trade-offs. It's either borrowing and paying it off in the future, or deciding we won't do something else now. And, you know, governments have to make those decisions about those trade-offs. And we then get to decide whether we like what they do at the ballot box. Is there an issue with the broader Australian community? Do you think we are coming around to a point of view where there is a broader understanding within the Australian community about their fellow citizens that suffer from various forms of mental health? And do you think the community accepts that we need to do more? And if not, what could we do to improve that, do you think?
I'm actually really hopeful in this regard, because I think we have seen really significant changes in community attitudes. I mean, I take as an example, I'm in Victoria, so talk about footy. You know, Dustin Martin taking time, Richmond's star player, undeniably, taking time out from playing footy during the season when his team is not performing all that well to look after his own mental health. The fact that he took it, the fact that he could talk about it openly in that was the reason for it. And the footy club has done nothing but support that decision. I'm sure there's been some frustration around it and they wished that he was well. I think that that is a fundamentally different set of circumstances than you would have seen 10 years ago. I don't think you would have seen that level of acceptance at all. So I think that's really positive that we are seeing the signs and accepting that people who are mentally unwell need to be supported and need to be given the treatment that they that will help them recover. And, you know, we're seeing Dusty's back playing. So I'm not saying that he was necessarily unwell, but this was really strong positive action to take to look after his mental health. And I think that's really good. And I think, you know, that most Tigers supporters that I've spoken to anyway see that as a good thing. And see that, you know, it's really important for him to get well and they're really welcoming him back to the club. I think, you know, 15 years ago he would have been called soft.
Yeah, no, you're or told to go for an extra half a dozen laps around the oval to run it off. Yeah. You know, and he's not the first high-profile sportsman. I think Ben Stokes year or so ago stepped down from the English team at a time when, they, in a sense, they probably couldn't afford to lose him. But
that's right.
And it is admirable, I think, that they're willing to do that. And even, you know, you look at people like Ash Barty, who I'm not suggesting suffers from ill health, but she's made a very mature decision about what she wants from life and isn't just feeling pressured into doing what other people want her to do. So I think they're all good role models.
Absolutely. Also a Tigers supporter, which is a bit of a mark against her name, but we can't be perfect. She seems to be in just about every other way.
Neither of us like that, although neither of us see the eye to eye on that either. Anyway, look, I think that's been a great discussion, Annabelle. I really appreciate you joining me today, and I think your insights on this these issues are really, really valuable and important.
Thanks very much, Paul. It's been a pleasure.
No problems. And thank you to everyone for joining us today. Tune in next month for another insider take on what's happening in the headlines, or visit acelallen.com.au for more in-depth articles and insights. Thank you very much.